So Parshas Bereishis is arguably the most depressing parsha in the Torah. You have the creation of the world, and then you have not just the first murder, but if you just read it, it's arguable that everything that happens in Parshas Bereishis following the creation is in fact a failure. Right? Most obviously of the story of Adam and Chava and the Nachash and the Eitz Hadas, which is, as Chazal points out, man was given everything except for, you know, one little thing, and human nature being what it is, you tell a person they can't have something, that becomes the focus of their life. People are small-minded in that way, in that we don't realize how reactionary we are. You tell somebody they can't have something, all of a sudden it becomes the most desirable thing in the world, and that's what the story of the Eitz Hadas established, and then you move from there to the next generation, to Cain and Hevel, and you have jealousy and fratricide. And then, of course, by the end of the parsha, you have Vayiru b'nei Elokim espinos ha'adam ki tovos heina, Vayichu ha'am nashim mikol asher bacharu, or whatever exactly that means. It's very obscure, but that led to the mabul. So you have just story after story after story after story after story after failure, and that makes Parshas Bereishis an incredibly depressing parsha, and there's hardly any kind of sunshine. So it's in that context that I want to take a look at a number of psukim, which could be read in one of two directions. Again, because of all of the major, major themes of Bereishis, creation of the world, the institution of Shabbos, Puru Revu, Cain and Hevel, Adam and Chava and the Nachash, and the promise of destruction that looms over the end of Parshas Bereishis, these psukim almost never get read. But I think that they're super interesting, and it's always been a dream of mine to actually give a shiur on this topic. We all have our dreams. And so I wanted to touch on this topic this morning. Okay, so there was a man named Lamech, and Lamech is a very esoteric character. His relationship to Cain is in the psukim, but we don't know exactly what it means, and there's many, many midrashim on the topic. Vayikach lo Lamech shtei nashim. So what we know is that Lamech took two wives, shem ha'achat Ada v'shem ha'sheni Tzila. One of them is named Ada, and one of them is named Tzila. Now, why did he need two wives? This itself is something which the Torah has a lot to say about. Well, why do you think you need to? Again, when Hashem created man, it was clear that he created a monogamous institution of marriage. Al ken yazov yishas avi v'zimo v'davach v'ishto v'hayu l'basar echad. Right, that they should have. Yeah, Donnie.
I mean, Rabbi Levine this morning. He said we see the first death.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they didn't know what marriage really was. Maybe they were discovering that in a new way, and they thought maybe you could have more than one wife.
Right, so again, you have the model, a very interesting point, you have the model of Adam and Chava, though, which were, one-to-one. So you would have thought that people would have continued in that direction. And again, that's like sort of filled with romance and filled with this image of Al Kain Yazov Ish as Avibes Imo Vidavak Bi Ishto.
That
much is true, but you could have seen a paradigm there. That's true. I'm not denying that Adam, didn't have that many options, but look at Adam's reaction when he sees Chava for the first time. Zos ha'pa'am, etzem me'atzamayu v'sarmi v'sari. It's one of the most romantic psukim that we have in all of Tanakh, and it comes right at the beginning. So what's happening here? So Chazal were of the view that this was a cynical move on Lamech's part, but one which is not unfamiliar to us, that one of the women was for, and one of them was for procreation.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that was actually, yes, correct. Yes, that was, and they derived that from the names. Ada means the one who was scorned. In other words, he wasn't truly romantic about her, but her purpose was pragmatic. Tzila was Yosheves Bitzilo. He wanted her to hang around. That was more of a lustful connection. Now, and ultimately, she, to put it in modern parlance, refuses to take her birth control, which is a whole other story in the Medrash, and she ends up having a child in her own right. But what you see here, again, what I'm trying to highlight is the degradation, a cynical degradation of what was meant to be an institution of great aspiration and ambition. Again, Al Kain Yazov Ishes Avibes Imo V'Davach V'Ishto V'Hayu L'Basar Echad. A beautiful institution, which all of a sudden is degraded. I just wanted to point that out as yet another one of the many failures of Parshas Bereishis. Vatelet Adat Yaval, her first child was Yaval, hu haya avi yoshev ohel u'mikne. What was he the father of? What's Yoshev Olamikna? Igor.
It's the nomads.
Yeah, exactly. He was the first nomad. There were shepherds before him, but he took it to a whole new level, and he was an economic entrepreneur, a pioneer in his way, right? This is an incredibly important stage in the human development, the development of nomadic life, and he was the father of that. V'shem Achiv, there's not a separate birth, so many of the commentaries point out that they think it was, in fact, a twin birth. V'shem Achiv Yuval, he was father of what?
Musicians.
Of all musicians. Now, and then just I'll go one more pasuk, and then we'll bring it back together. Tzila, who was supposed to be the woman who was just for sexual gratification, she herself gave birth to Tuval Kayin. Lotesh kol choresh nechoshet uvarzel. What does that mean? Lotesh kol choresh nechoshet uvarzel.
Weapons.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is so
with metals.
Because it's Kayin is connected with that.
Very, very good. Excellent, Steve. The Achotu Valkayin Na'ama, who is she? Who is Na'ama?
Sister.
The sister of Tuval Kayin, but also, whose wife does she become? Noach's wife.
Noach,
and
yes.
And she's called Na'ama, according to Chazal, because Ni'imos Ma'aseha, she was a very worthy kind of person, a person of morality, she was a befitting maid for Noach. Now, most of the people that we encounter in Sefer Bereishis, we're told not a word about them, not a word about their lives, or what they accomplished, or what they did. So isn't it remarkable that this one man, Lemech, has four children, and each one of the four is outstanding and exceptional in their own way? Na'ama, for who she marries, but also, as Chazal say, because of the uniqueness of her actions and of her character, but leaving even Na'ama aside, the three sons are all Nobel Prize winners. The first one, Yaval, initiates a whole kind of way of life that didn't exist before him, and the Torah deems that significant enough for us to know about it. And Yuval is the father of art and music, and Tuval Kayin, it makes very important technological advances. So it's just striking that in one family, again, you have many, many people in Bereishis, we know nothing about them, presumably because they didn't accomplish anything that groundbreaking. That's the whole genealogy, you go through the years. And this in one family, you have three incredibly important developments in human history. Talk about, you know, an anthropological dream. One family, the development of metals for weapons, the development of nomadic lifestyle, and Tofes Kinor V'Ugav, the development of music. And it's so strange. I mean, like, what are the genetic chances that you'd have three brilliant children and four exceptional children? It's a shocking thing. So the Ramban... That's true, but even that, absolutely true. But you rarely see, even amongst the very bright people, you rarely see this level, how many people in the history of Nobel Prizes, how many siblings have won Nobel Prizes? I don't think any, as far as I'm concerned.
How about
something
like the Bach family?
That's true.
They were geniuses, and all of them were.
Right. So, I mean, sometimes you have this, but it's just highly unusual. So if you take...
This is an extreme case, probably.
It's a very extreme case, exactly as Donnie points out. So if you take a look at the Ramban, it's in Source 2, the Ramban does something very sharp. Which shouldn't surprise us. Aval hanira be'enai, he says, what's happening here? Ki haya lemech ishchacha me'od b'chom lachas machshaves. Lemech was a genius, a unique genius, perhaps, up until his point, the smartest man who had ever lived. V'limei libno ha'bechor inyan ha'mirah kifi tivei ha'behemos. He taught his eldest son about mir'eh, kefi tivei ha'behemos. He essentially taught him the secrets to how to conduct animals and nomadic life. V'limeid es hasheni chachmas hanigun. And he taught his second son what?
Music.
V'limeid es hashlishi lulto shalasos charavos, or yeah, charavos urimachim v'chanisos, swords and spears and other forms of metallic weapons. V'chol klei ha'melchama. So what question is Ramban answered, Paul? What is he saying here? Is it that it was, you know, each one of the kids was a genius, or the father was a genius, and the father taught all of them? What the Ramban is really doing is he's implicitly answering the question, how is this happening? But what's also really fascinating is that the Ramban, by answering that question, is presenting this magnificent and fascinating specter of the first genius. The first true genius, that Lemech was generations and generations ahead of his time, and he was able single-handedly to further human development. Now, most of the people who comment about it, most of the Rishonim, should say, take a positive view of these things. In other words, that the Torah is going out of its way to tell us these things because the Torah is interested in recording, you know, Zeh Sefer Toldo Sa'adam, and the Torah is interested in recording advances in human history. It's of interest to the Torah. But another way to read all of these psukim is, again, just as most things in Sefer Bereishis represent moral failures, as we detailed, that these things were all codes for developments in Avodah Zarah or Shvichos Damim. Tubal Cain developed weapons for murder, and Yaval and Yuval, even though it sounds like they're doing good things, or at least neutral things, but probably good things, furthering human society, there is an approach in Chazal which Rashi quotes, which says that these things were actually code words for advances in Avodah Zarah. Avi Yoshev Ohel Umikneh was a code word for a certain kind of Avodah Zarah, and then Kol Tofeis Kinor V'Ugavis, he developed music for the service of Avodah Zarah. So I just want to point that out, to put that minority view on the record, which is that all of these things are part of the whole story of moral abyss in Parshas Bereishis, that they're all part of the Avodah Zarah complex. But we're going to follow the majority view, which is that these are all actually important events in terms of anthropology, human history, and civilization. Yeah, Donnie.
Yeah, don't you, I mean, they're defining it to some degree at that time what Avodah Zarah was.
Right.
Don't you think, and then, you know, the Gemara says that Avodah Zarah was stamped out.
Yes, correct.
Don't you think that,
correct. Absolutely correct.
That it wasn't really stamped out, that Avodah Zarah still exists even today, and you can relate it to hedonism? You can't just say that the Avodah Zarah was taken away, or just transformed into a different...
That's absolutely true. Dadani's pointing out is that whatever Avodah Zarah meant in their generation, doesn't necessarily mean that, okay, so Avodah Zarah that doesn't exist in exactly the same form today, it doesn't exist at all. I happen to agree with that. I had a great teacher, Rabbi Yitzchak Tursky, would always point out that Avodah Zarah is essentially self-worship. Yeah. Sometimes it's a very crude form of self-worship. You worship Ma'asei Adah, the things you actually created. But sometimes, it doesn't have to be that formalistic. In other words, it doesn't have to be of an object, but people worship themselves. They don't worship God, they essentially worship themselves. And that exists in great abundance today. If you don't believe me, I can introduce you to some people. That itself is really a form of Avodah Zarah. Right.
So it's not Avodah Zarah.
Right. Exactly.
It is ironic, though, that if you look at the story,
yeah,
the lineage of Cain, first, he was the one who actually initially worked the earth.
Excellent.
And then, when he's cursed with connection to the earth, he ends up building cities.
Yeah.
And all aspects of sort of creativity emerge from his line, whereas with Shane, you get a lineage of people, but you really don't get any sense that they actually did anything in terms of construction.
Cain is a great builder. There's no question about that. I think that's absolutely true. And I think that also, once you understand that insight, I think, not that we're going to get into this too deeply, but I think that explains also Cain's sense of disenfranchisement, disappointment. He's also the first one to offer the korban, mm-hmm. and it's not accepted. And he's thinking to himself, I'm accomplishing so much, I'm doing so much in the world, and I'm also the first one to offer a korban, and it's not accepted. You can understand why. When Hashem says the Kayam Mama Charalacha V'Lama Naflu Panach, I always think to myself, I know why. It's frustrating. Life is very frustrating. Okay, so I want to go down the basic approach within the Mishporshim here, that Yuval was truly a great innovator, and again, this doesn't have so much to do with Avodah Zarah. So if you take a look at the Ibn Ezra, Kinor V'Ugav, Mine Klei Niginot, V'hi Chachma Gedola, he said he innovated. This is not within the approach of the Ramban that it was the father, but the son was truly the innovator, and he had Chachma Gedola. So says the Radak, Hu haya harishon bechachmas hanigon. The Amar b'lashon tfisa. What does it say? Tofes kinor v'ugav, which literally means to grab on. Lefisha umanusahi betfisas yitrei hakinor. The way that you play the harp is by holding on to the strings. Biyadas molid kifiyashir shahore chachmahi. And the whole thing, the whole chachma, is of course to know how long to pluck and to hold the strings for. The Chizkuni just makes one very interesting point. V'shem achiv Yuval. They were actually twins. midloksim ve batelet od, because it never says that there was a separate birth. V'derachu etzel roim lios menagnim. And the reason that he developed music was to help his brother. His brother needed to get the animals to go where he wanted them to go, so music was developed as a tool in concert with the development of the nomadic lifestyle. The reason that I bring this up is that this is just from historical and anthropological standpoint, a very important point, which is that innovation breeds innovation. That's really what the Chizkuni is saying, that a technological or economic innovation of a new kind of lifestyle, the nomadic lifestyle, necessity is the mother of invention. Now there was necessity
for music.
So this is just true in life in general, right? If you develop the computer, you have all, then you have chips, you have silicon chips, and development of new technologies, and development eventually of the internet and mobile wireless devices. Innovation tends to breed innovation. And that's the way the Chizkuni, right, already in his generation, was aware of this. And he says, oh, it's not an accident that you have, everybody's trying to address the question is how you have so much innovation taking place at once. So the Ramban's approach is that you had a singular genius. And that genius was able to propagate innovation in all these areas. The Chizkuni is taking a slightly different approach, which is to say that you don't have a singular genius, but when you have innovation on one front, that tends to breed other innovation. And I just, the reason I'm so excited to discuss these things is because it's really true to this very day. And that's why you have people hanging out in places like Silicon Valley, because the idea is if you're around engines, idea engines, it breeds other ideas. That's the concept of university, etc., etc. Being in an environment where people are producing new things will help you produce new things. So the Chizkuni's pshat is that in the innovation of Yaval, in terms of Mikneh, the nomadic lifestyle, created the necessity where Yuval was unable to come in and use his abilities to say, okay, how can I further this enterprise? And it was all part of the same industry. Yeah, Dani.
This is true in all areas. The invention of oil paint was the great innovation in terms of art. And prior to that, art was really on a very much lower level. I mean, the invention of oil paint in the 1300s or so, 1400, I think, really preceded the invention of a great Renaissance art.
I'm quite certain that if you go to
also for the camera.
I'm quite certain that if you go
great photographers.
If you go through all of human history, if you go through periods of innovation, you'll see how one thing relates to the next. And that's the Chizkuni is reading that in terms of the first age of discovery, that each one is a kind of a cascade. No, Don, go ahead.
This might be too tangential, but
you brought
and I listened to the Shear words by Ravelli Marcus on music, and after all these holidays, it kind of irked me a lot that there was no music involved in our worship today, and you mentioned music, and it's always mentioned music, but yet, like, we still haven't, the Orthodox haven't incorporated it into any part of our spiritual lives during our spiritual, our holidays are supposed to be spiritual, like, time.
It's very musically oriented, I think. That's what it's all about, is the music.
Okay, excellent. So that is exactly where we're heading.
But it's not necessarily associated with an instrument.
Which appears to be more of a technical issue, but this is exactly the road that we're heading down, because what the Torah here is doing is it's equating, you have three discoveries, which the Torah is putting in the same context. On the one hand, you have what's clearly a technological innovation in terms of metals and weaponry, and then you have essentially an economic innovation, which is the nomadic lifestyle, which was going to allow people to travel from place to place. And then in the middle, you have this sort of artistic innovation, and the Torah seems to be equating and putting that on the same par as the other two, which is a very interesting perspective. And we might take it for granted, but it's the Torah really giving art a lot of prestige by elevating it to the level of the other technological innovations. And what I like to, the way that I like to formulate this is the Torah really recognizing the power of art and the power of music. And that's really what I want to discuss. Which is the issue that Paul and Donnie are relating to, is what is the power of
subject?
What is the power of art? That is exactly where we're headed. So I'm happy that you're here for this week. Yeah.
Correlation between, for example, mathematical ability and musical ability.
Einstein.
And it's one of those examples that you can actually use the same sort of conceptual structures that are involved in things like engineering and physics and chemistry to actually create another sort of mode in terms of appealing to aspects of artistry. So they actually tap on the same sort of aspects.
Yeah, I think that's, I guess Einstein is a classical example of that. But
another area, the invention of the piano preceded the greatest pieces ever written for the piano by Beethoven. In other words,
he couldn't have the internet before you had the computers. Mm-hmm. So you need to have
the technology. No, I understand, but the internet isn't necessarily artistic.
No, but you have to have the media before.
Paul's just saying that in general, that there's a certain structure to innovation in general.
Oh, yeah. Usually it's the internet.
Yeah, they have a harpsichord before you can have a piano.
You know, the World Wide Web.
but your point is the most important thing. Well, usually the greatest art usually follows fairly quickly after the invention of these.
These things are always,
at least in our modern society.
It always related to each other. So these are all, this is all very interesting. I want to just read you a passage from Refers. This is not, this is originally written in German. I'll just present it in Hebrew. But it was a German piece that he wrote here. So he also took notice of the fact that the Torah here is given great prominence to music. You can't get away from that. Because otherwise, why is the Torah reporting this? So Refers had the following to say. Yuval, avikol tefes kinor v'ugav. Hava omer, hamanut. This is actually not only talking about music, but art in general. That Yuval was really the first great artist. His specialty was music, but the way that Rav Hirsch thinks of it is that when you think about music, you have to think about art more generally, which is interesting.
So it was Da Vinci.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So hamanut, he tzorach be'olamo shel kayin, lo pachos min hamalach. We're obviously dealing here with Kayin's lineage, and he says, music is as essential as any kind of technology. Why? Mishenifrad ha'adam me'eitz Hashem. If you go back to Adam and Chava's expulsion from the Gan, sar ha'shalom ilibo, that triggered a kind of emotional and existential crisis for man. It wasn't only a geographic exile, but a kind of estrangement. An estrangement which had psychological and emotional impact on man. What is the nature of art? Ha'omanut mivakesh ha'chzir lo es ha'shalom. This is a very profound little paragraph here. So he says that really the function of art is to restore tranquility to the soul of man. This should also be understood in the context of so many great artists, obviously, being plagued by all kinds of emotional disturbances, which is a real topic in its own right. But what Rav Hirsch is touching on here is that the function of art is to give man some sense of peace, some way of dealing with his predicament. Al yidei inyan, just 1 second, Igor. Al yidei inyan habalo min hachutz, through an external stimulus. Davarza amor biyichud bimuzika. This is true of art in general, but it's especially true of the art of music. It doesn't attempt to imitate forms and symbols. What it really tries to do is appeal directly to the emotions. Rav Hirsch was a great music lover. It expresses and
awakens.
That's a great translation. It awakens certain emotions.
Aiden.
That's the word that he's using. He's using that word deliberately from Gan Eden. It brings a kind of tranquility and pleasure to the soul. Kechol omanut yafa, just as in the case of every fine art, harehi shlav rishon v'malod hachinuch, it's of extreme pedagogical value, v'kras erkei ha'emes v'atov. Because it's so emotionally significant, this is why music and art are such an important part of education, early education. Because what you're trying to do is give the student, in this case the young child, a kind of emotional attachment to the subject matter. That's why in early Torah education, you don't want to stress music and art projects, which give the children a kind of emotional attachment to the holidays, to their religion, etc. So what Rav Hirsch is doing, and I want to use this as a segue for the next part of this year, which is really what Paul and Donnie were touching on, is Rav Hirsch is saying the reason the Torah is talking about music is because music and art matter. And they matter because they speak directly to man's emotional core in a way that very few other things do. And the Torah recognized from the very beginning the capacity of music to have a great impact on men. And the examples that he gives are, you know, when a person is feeling disturbed, music can calm them in a very unique way. What's the classical example in Tanakh of that? Who was disturbed and went for music therapy? Exactly. Shaul had a ruach ra'ah, which is essentially a depression. If you read the psukim carefully, it sounds like it was some form of a severe depression. I wouldn't say even a clinical depression. Shaul became, it says ruach ra'ah. He had a kind of...
I'm sure that also, I mean, if you read Tehillim, I mean, it looks like someone that's despondent and that is...
David HaMelech certainly struggled with that.
It's
not
depressing.
I think that Shaul really sounds a little bit having different manic phases.
And wasn't there a concept, yeah. I don't know, of 10 shirim in Tanakh?
Yes.
Was one of the first shir adam? Am I remembering?
Absolutely, yeah, in Chazal, exactly.
Yes. So one of his responses was in fact, was to...
100%. That's a very good makor to bring up in this context. I didn't think of that, but that's a very good makor.
Yeah. 100%.
That's great. That's a great, very, very good. Yeah, Donnie, go ahead.
Excellent makor. Some of these figures and being manic, I actually read something interesting. It said that someone that's manic, their IQ is raised by 30%. So if they're known for being a smart person, I would say they have to have some sort of mania.
Oh, it's interesting. That's very interesting. Yeah, I would say Shaul was the more, had manic and depressive phases. But, so that was a... But it says that the Tanakh says Ruach Ra'ah. It does, it's not only, it really was some kind of a physiological event. So in any event... We know that music has great therapeutic value, that's what Rupersh is talking about, but then it also has great pedagogical and educational value. That's why he's talking about the emotional impact it can have in the educational setting. And that's really my launching point for the next part of this year. The Torah, as expressed so beautifully by Rupersh, recognized the power of music. That's why the Torah told us about the introduction of music. And that's also why, if you take a look at the Gemara and Gittin and Daf Zayin in verse 8, is that if music is a powerful tool, a very powerful tool in a constructive sense, we talked about the therapeutic value, the educational value, music can also be a very powerful tool, but for destructive purposes. Let me show you a Gemara which not many people are aware of. The Gemara which I think, perhaps more than any other source in Torah Shebaal Peh, speaks to the emotional power of music. Shalchu leila Marukva. The following question was posed to Marukva. Zimra minalan de asir. How do we know that music is prohibited? Not something we normally think of, but the Amoraim were weighing the idea that maybe music entirely should be prohibited. Kasav lehu, al tismach Yisrael, rejoice not, O Israel, al gil be'amim. Do not rejoice amongst the nations. So this Al Tismach Yisrael, Al Gil Ba'amim is being interpreted by Mar Okva, the Pasuk in Hosea and Treyasar, to be proscribing and prohibiting music. V'lishlach lehu mehacha, why didn't he quote a Pasuk in Yeshayahu? Bishir lo yishtu yayin, they should never drink wine in a place where they are singing. Yemar Sheikhar Lishotav. Sheikhar, beer should become bitter to its drinkers. So Imehahu, if you had quoted them that pasuk, which outlaws Shir, Hava Mina Hani Mile Zimra Demana, Aval Defuma Shari, you would have thought that that pasuk really allows singing, vocal singing, not instrumental, Kamash Malan, that both vocal, a cappella singing, and instrumental music are forbidden. So this Gemara, we have to see whether we paskin like it or not, categorically forbids music. And you'd have to ask yourself, well, what's so bad about music? But again, once you understand that music has an incredible emotional pull on a person, maybe Chazal were concerned that it should lead a person in the wrong direction. Now, what does that mean? Well, we have to try to interpret that. So we find two schools of thought within the Rishonim. But again, this Gemara doesn't necessarily explain itself. All it says is that music is prohibited. which is a very important Gemara. Now, we all know that there's music today, so we're kind of wondering, well, how could this be true? But
music in general?
The Gemara seems to say music in general is prohibited, both singing and instrumental music.
Is that how he brought it in? Distinguish it from Chaim and...
Okay, good. So we're going to see how we get there.
In general? Or just
yeah, well, that's the Gemara says. The Gemara...
Okay, good.
So, but when was the Gemara? Was after the Beis HaMikdash. So it's true that maybe there was an exception for the Beis HaMikdash, but does the Gemara qualify itself?
No.
No?
So it just says in general.
In general. So let's see. The Rishonim all work to mitigate the Gemara and say, no, the Gemara is only talking about X, the Gemara is only talking about Y, the Gemara doesn't talk about Z. And the Rishonim do that in two distinct ways. So let's take a look at four Rishonim, which are all more or less within one school of thought. And that what the Gemara is really prohibiting is not music per se, but music in a context which could lead to inappropriate sexual behavior. Even before I want to read the Rishonim inside, the reason I think this dovetails beautifully with what we said in the first half of this year, which spoke about the power of music and the importance of the innovation of music, is that once you recognize how strong an emotional pull music can have on people, that works in both directions. Again, music can inspire people religiously. It can provide great comfort to people psychologically. It can lift a person's spirits. It can have a great educational value, teaching it, using it as a religious tool. But music can also excite in a particular way. So you take a look at the Ritva. The Ritva was one of the Talmidim, the Grand Talmidim in the school of the Ramban, a very important Rishon. Zimra min alan de aser, kasvu b'shem ha-ga'onim. It was the tradition of the Ga'onim, de'eno aser el ashir shel cheshek. What's ashir shel cheshek? Igor, how do you translate cheshek? Exactly, what? Yeah, erotic music.
So
the Ritva is limiting the Gemara considerably. The Ritva is interpreting the Gemara only to be prohibiting which kind of music? The music itself is not a problem. It's only music which leads to eroticism, which is the issue. And likewise, Rashi, if you take a look at Zimra, L'shorer beveis hamishtaos. To sing where? Where there's alcohol being served. Again, because if the concern is it's going to lead to inappropriate behavior, it's not music which is so much a problem, but music in the wrong context. So the Ritva says it's erotic music, Rashi says it's music in a context where people are going to be drinking, and when they're going to be drinking, their inhibitions are going to be relaxed, and it's going to serve...
Of course Chazal knew about this.
That's exactly what the case is. And we're not prohibiting music, Rashi and the Ritva are saying, we're prohibiting music that can lead a person, that pulls a person in the direction of inappropriate behavior. And Tosos, if you take a look at Source 11, first endorses Rashi's pshat, and he brings a Gemara in Sanhedrin, which supports it. And then he has this last line here, v'shir shal mitzvah shari. However, any shir shal mitzvah is permissible. Kigon v'shas chuppah, for example, in a wedding, sh'osin l'sameach chasan v'kala. And it's not a random distinction. But again, it's a recognition that music has great power, which means that when it comes to music, context is everything.
And I think you can say that so nice, because I was looking here in Shemot. I mean, what Yeshua and Moshe hear is essentially a shir, the call.
Excellent. Right. And what were the people doing there? What does it say specifically? By Yakuma Amutzachek, the people were involved in a kind of musical orgiastic behavior. That's a classic example, the Egel Azav, of music being used to in the service, not just of Avodah Zarah, but of Znus. So again, Tosus is making precisely this distinction. He says context is everything. If it's a context that's spiritual, this is what Donnie was saying before, in davening or at a wedding where it's going to inspire the right kind of emotional response, that's exactly where not only are we allowed to have music, but we'd want to have music. And on the other hand, if it's the wrong context, then music is going to be a destructive force. Either way, we're recognizing the emotional power of music. Just wanted to quote a beautiful line here from the Me'iri. The Me'iri also goes down this pshat, down this mahalich, and he says, but how do you define what's inappropriate music, what's acceptable music? Yeah, Donnie.
I mean, I know it sounds a little weird, but everyone experiences, like, if you go to a concert, everyone's experience is different. Like, my friend will say, oh, if he listens to, like, techno music, he reminds him of, like, you know, raging, you know? But let's say you use that music to work or, you know, whatever. So the context of the music is really of when you experienced, let's say, when you experienced and how you experienced it. It's not just the music itself. I mean, he might associate it with, you know, whatever it is, drugs.
Right, exactly, that's right.
I could be experiencing it in a totally different level, whereas, if, you know, it made me work more efficiently during my day, and it was a peaceful, I didn't associate it with raging, it was just, you know, or, you know, partying.
What Donnie's saying is absolutely true. If you take a look at the Meiri, that's exactly what the Meiri says. The Meiri's also going down this basic approach, and so the Meiri says, "Well, how do you define inappropriate music?" So you just take a look at the part that I bolded. It says 5 lines down. Ein lo l'dayin be'elu elamash ein avroos l'fi mekomam v'shasam. Remember the Supreme Court Justice, when they asked him, what's the definition of pornography? What did he say? I'll know it when I see it. So that comes straight out of the Meiri. It's very subjective. And a person, it almost has to be what I would call a self-policing thing. Is that a person knows, you have to be honest about it, a person, you can't make rationalizations, but a person knows what they find enticing and what they don't find enticing. Lefim ekomam v'shasam.
That's a mean violent sound of a rabbi, that's in your place. The woman or something says, are you dancing? I don't think about this as a sexual.
Exactly, that's right. That's exactly what the Meiri is saying, is that a person has to know themselves, and a person has to know what their standards are. But what all these Rishonim are basically arguing is that music is not the problem. What's the problem?
You.
Yeah, the context, the way you interpret it, let's say if it's with the alcohol or it's clearly erotic music, but if it's in the context of a mitzvah, this is what Tosfos is pointing out, then music is essential. Now, there's a whole different approach in the Rishonim. Again, the Gemara didn't say this. The Gemara just said music is prohibited, and not only instrumental music, but singing as well. The Rambam interpreted the Gemara completely differently, nothing having to do with the boundaries, sexual behavior boundaries, but the Rambam said this is all in light of the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. Take a look at source 13. V'chein gazru shelo l'nagein b'chli shir v'chol minei zemer v'chol mashmi kol shel shir aser lismoach behen v'aser l'shoman mipnei achorban. How would you summarize the Rambam's view? Why should music be prohibited? Exactly, it's really a din in avelus. What the Rambam, in his own way, is testifying to the emotional power of music. How so? It's because music is such a powerful emotional tool, it causes such unique satisfaction. We don't want to experience that in a world in which the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. We want to reserve music, as Herschel said, for the context of Mikdash, and for a time where we can celebrate Hashem's presence among. If Hashem's not going to be present in the Beis HaMikdash, we do not want to allow ourselves. Rather, we wish to deny ourselves this kind of pleasure.
Actually, you read the line still.
Excellent. I was hoping you'd bring that up.
In Teman, they had no instrumental music in Teman.
For this reason, because the Temanim, more than any other community, were influenced by the Rambam. And they took the approach that it's not a question of pritzos, as you know, that's the way that Rashi and Tosfos and the Meiri and the Ritva conceptualized the Gemara, but the way that the Rambam thought about it is, again, it, in his own way, it testifies to the emotional power of music, but since it's such an uplifting force, right, we don't want to allow ourselves to experience that kind of joy absent the Chorban. And he says, V'afilu shira b'pe'al hayayin asura. We don't want to sing in the context of yayin. Rashi also had that. Shenemar b'shir lo yishtu yayin. However, even the Rambam himself will note, Ukvar nahagu kol Yisrael lomar divrei tishbachos o shir shel hoda'os la'el v'chayotze bahen al hayayin. He says, but you should just know that there is the tradition of singing zmiros, let's say, at seudos mitzvah. Weddings where there's yayin and, let's say, seudos purim or whatever it is. The Rambam was aware of this. So, and the Rambam is testifying to the fact that even though he does think that all these things should be on some level prohibited, he says the minhag amongst the Jewish people was not to go to this extreme, and they allowed themselves, again, in which context? In the context of Divrei Tishbachos, to use music as a religious tool, which is exactly the debate that Paul and Donnie were having before, is that, you know, once you recognize the power, the emotional power of music, there's a great spiritual cost not to include that in our services. And that was, you know, from, I'm sure Paul could tell us a lot about this, in terms of the battles between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. That was one of the issues, the incorporation of music into the liturgy, into the services. And again, it's this issue of how much do we want it to be a pure intellectual experience, and that our connection should be mediated primarily through an intellectual, or to use davening as a kind of emotional, rapturous experience, an ecstatic experience, one of ecstasy, where music has a large role to play. All of these, just to take it one step further with the Shulchan Aruch, who is influenced here by the Rambam, Mechaber writes, V'chein gazru shelo lenagin b'kli shir, v'chol minei zemer, v'chol mashmi'e kol shel shir lismo'ach b'hem. That's straight from the Rambam. And then the Rambam says, V'yesh omim davka misha ragil b'hem. There are those who limit it only to people who are, you know, make regular practice of it. Kigon ha-malachim sh'omdin b'shofen b'kli shir, obi'veis ha-mishteh. That's the perspective of the Torah, which is being quoted by the Ramah, which would allow for music to be played in a more haphazard way. But the Mechaber then goes on to say, "V'aser l'shomam b'pnei achorban." This is all a result of the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. V'afilu shir b'pal ayayin asur shenemar b'shir lo yishtu yayin u'kvar nagu kol Yisrael lomar divrei tishbachos v'shir sholdos v'zichron chaste kadosh baruch hu al hayayin. Again, the Mechaber just quotes the Rambam verbatim. Agad, the Ramah says, which of course we know comes from the Bali Atosis. So what we really saw today in three different contexts were various testimonies to the power of music. Number one, V'shem Achiv Yuval, Hu Ayavi Kol Tofes Kinor V'Ugav. The Torah considered the development of music, and if you take Rav Hirsch's approach, art in general, to be a significant milestone in human history. And specifically because music is so powerful, Chazal, in the Gemara and Gittin, sought to limit music in one of two ways. The way that the Rambam and those who follow the Rambam interpreted, as a result of the Chorban HaBayis, we can't allow ourselves to experience that kind of joy. Otherwise, we won't acutely feel the loss of the Mikdash. The Chazal were always looking for ways to preserve the idea that the reality that we live in today is a shattered and broken one. And allowing music would have taken away from the acuteness of that sensibility. And therefore, it was important to prohibit music so that we know that the true happiness in life is when Hashem is truly dwelling within our midst in the context of Mikdash. That's the approach of the Rambam, and the Rav Yosef Karo quotes that verbatim in the Shulchan Aruch. There was a whole other school of Rishonim who didn't interpret this as anything to do with the Churban. They also spoke to the power of music, but specifically the power of the music, like Herschel's term, to excite, and to excite in the wrong way. And that's why they said what this Gemara is really speaking to is erotic music. So that's what the Ritva said. It's only talking about erotic songs. And the Bali Atosha said, for that reason, it's permissible in any context of a mitzvah, because the context itself makes sure that it won't be an erotic experience, but an intense spiritual one. And the Meiri came along and said, well, how do I know what's erotic and what's not? It's got to be subjective. A person has to be self-policing. Rashi himself had this type of idea when he said, Rashi said, the Gemara is only speaking in the context where people already are uninhibited, where there's alcohol present. But what I'm really interested here is, again, it's not a modern idea that music is a very powerful tool. So yeah, go ahead, Donnie.
I know this is like kind of blown up the whole thing, but our struggles today are not with something minutia like this. Even if you want to go a step further, like things that are more tempting that we should be worried about, it's not whether or not we're looking at music or not, or which we're looking at.
Well, right, well, I think that right, it could be a separate issue, but that I think is more or less what the Meiri was speaking to. That's exactly what he says. A person has to know, in terms of the context of this Gemara and Gittin, our tolerance, this is probably a bit of a sad commentary on us, but because we're exposed to so much, our tolerance might be that much greater. Whereas in a society that was had a much higher standard of what's acceptable and what's not, much less than what we're comfortable listening to would be considered a breach. That is always, I think, a crucial insight in matters of tznius, is that it's going to depend on the society. But either way, there's going to be, I think what is true is that there are certain things which will always be very erotically stimulating. You know, certain kinds of songs or certain kinds of dances, just in their very nature. So I just think that what I'm trying to shed a bit of light on is this idea that the Torah and Chazal were very acutely aware of music, going all the way back to the beginning of Bereishis, and they recognized its constructive capacity, and then also its destructive capacity. The bottom line is that music is a very, very powerful thing, and that was something that Judaism and Chazal were always aware of. Our challenge, of course, is to take all the wonderful things about music and to use it in as spiritually productive a way as possible. I could just share, conclude with
share something.
Yeah, Jerry, go ahead. Sure.
Oh, okay. Well, this is a personal.